Hello, everyone. Thanks so much for listening to Getting Savvy in Health, Wealth, and Beauty. Important to note that everything is for entertainment purposes only. Please do speak and meet with a financial advisor before making any investment decisions. And also, please meet and speak with your GP before making any health or beauty decisions.
Hi, everybody. Happy Friday. Welcome to another episode of Getting Savvy. Today, the format's going to be a little bit different. My co-host, Catherine Murray, is on vacation in Europe, and she is lucky to be avoiding this horrible weather we've had in Toronto with the nonstop rain. And I think this is like the coldest weather we've had on record in Toronto for May in like years. So I don't know what that says about global warming. Anyhow, so we're going to do it a little different. I'm going to talk about some of the health topics that have caught my interest over the past week. And then a little bit later in the episode, I'm going to have my partner, Adam Marcus, come on and talk about some of the news that's been going on with the markets. Because even just looking at my phone today, it seems the markets have been not happy with Trump's new bill that he's proposing. I forget what he's calling it, something like the Great American Big Beautiful Bill or something like that. I don't know. Anyhow, we can talk more about that later. But I guess I want to get started first with the big news that was health news this week was the Joe Biden news that he has stage 4 prostate cancer. So I wanted to talk a little bit about prostate cancer, what this means, and how some people are talking about the fact that how could this just be revealed now at this late stage? How didn't they know this before? Could this have been concealed? And why I don't necessarily think that that's true, why I do think they may have just found out recently. So let's first talk about prostate cancer screening. So prostate cancer screening is actually quite controversial. So in Canada, the guidelines for screening depend on who you ask. So if you're looking at the Canadian Task Force on Preventative Health, they actually recommend against screening for prostate cancer, meaning they find that there's no benefit, or actually that the risks outweigh any potential benefit from doing a screening PSA test. So you may have heard about this PSA test before. PSA stands for prostate-specific antigen. And many doctors, including myself, have for years included this on the annual physical blood work panel. And simply because typically when that number starts to rise, it suggests that something's going on with the prostate. One thing could be that it's inflamed. It could be a prostatitis, or it could be just general enlargement that happens with aging, something that we call benign, so not cancerous, prostatic hypertrophy, or it can symbolize prostate cancer. So how did Joe Biden just found out now at stage 4, meaning it's metastasized, that he has prostate cancer? Wasn't he following this, you know, every year? And typically that's what we do with PSA. We look at the PSA velocity, meaning we'll do a test and we see the number. But that number, unless it's super high, doesn't mean much unless we see it rising and the doubling time. So if you do a PSA and 1 year it's at 3 and then the next year it's up at 10, that signifies that maybe something is going on with the prostate that could indicate cancer. However, the Canadian Task Force on Preventative Health recommends against doing this test because they don't think that it improves mortality more so than it has negative outcomes, such as, you know, unnecessary biopsies, adverse reactions to treatment, erectile dysfunction, and urinary incontinence. So specifically, men under age 55 and those over 70, the Canadian Task Force gives a strong recommendation against screening due to lack of evidence for mortality reduction and potential harms from overdiagnosis and overtreatment. In other words, you know, this is for Canada. So if Joe Biden was in Canada, you know, being over the age of 70, he wouldn't be screened with a PSA. And it wouldn't be until he, you know, came forward with symptoms that they would then test him. And this is the same recommendation pretty much in the U.S. when it comes to their preventative task force. They suggest that men don't get the PSA unless they're having symptoms. So what are some symptoms of prostate cancer? So it can be asymptomatic, or you could start presenting with some blood in the urine or urinary incontinence or urinary changes. It could present with bone pain if it's metastasized to the bones. You could have weight loss or fatigue. So it's possible. And I think I did read that he was having some urinary symptoms, which led them to investigate. So it's possible that he never had a PSA. And given the fact that he was running for president, I don't think they would want to do any unnecessary tests, which might diagnose him with something. So it's actually quite possible that during his term, they wouldn't be testing his PSA as a screening test, because what benefit's going to come of it, right? So it's possible that now that he's no longer president, they did this test and lo and behold, it's positive. So let's go back to when I said this test was controversial. So the Canadian Task Force on Preventative Health here in Canada recommends against screening. However, the Canadian Urological Association has a different opinion. They feel that men aged 50 and older, particularly those that are healthy with a life expectancy greater than 10 years, should get screened with a PSA test every year. And they also recommend that men at higher risk, including those with a family history of prostate cancer, or men of African or Caribbean ancestry, start screening at age 45, or men that have the BRCA positive gene, because that puts them at increased risk for prostate cancer as well. So it's something that's important to talk to your doctor about. And, you know, for family doctors like myself, it sort of leaves us confused. Do we follow the Canadian Urological Association's advice, or do we follow the advice of the Canadian Task Force on Preventative Health? Or do we just have a discussion with the patient and then make this joint decision? And ultimately, that's what it does come down to. You talk to the patient, you say, would you rather know, or ignorance is bliss, don't test me. So this is a conversation that it's important to have with your family doctor. You know, a lot of times people, you know, Catherine and I always talk about this, how we have to just advocate for our own health. We can't just sit back passively and let our doctor just do the test, because at the end of the day, we don't know which guideline they're following. You might be thinking that your husband, or you if you're a man, is being tested for prostate cancer, having this PSA test, and it might not even be on their panel. And you may be somebody that would prefer to know, even if that means unnecessary treatment and workup. Or your doctor may test you and then come back and say to you, oh, we think that your level is increasing. You need to go to a urologist. You need to go down this whole rabbit hole of working it up. And you might be upset because you would rather have not known and had to deal with that decision. So it's something that you really need to think about and talk to your doctor about. So that being said, now that he has been diagnosed with prostate cancer, what does that mean? So he was given a diagnosis of stage 4 cancer, so that's the highest stage. So what does that mean? That means that the cancer has spread beyond his prostate into other distant organs. So the most common place for prostate cancer to spread is bone. And so I believe that his has spread to bone, and that's why he's stage 4. Some men can experience pain when it spreads to their spine or hips, and other men don't even realize it. So it just depends on how it's an individual reaction. So then what is there to do? Well, at this stage, stage 4 prostate cancer, it's not curable. However, it can be treated very effectively. And they often say that more men die with prostate cancer than of prostate cancer, meaning that even though they have prostate cancer, it's more likely that they'll die of something else, like a heart attack or heart disease or something unrelated, than from the prostate cancer itself. So most common way to treat it is androgen deprivation therapy. So basically what that means is reducing testosterone levels. So testosterone can feed many prostate cancers. And I believe Joe Biden's is the type that is responsive to androgen deprivation. So they'll give him medication that blocks his testosterone, and hopefully he doesn't react too poorly from that. Some men don't have side effects. Other men's experience, almost similar to what a woman would experience when she goes through menopause. With the drop in hormone, they can get hot flashes, night sweats, fatigue, weight gain, muscle loss, brain fog. So hopefully he won't be affected too strongly by that. I know there's already talk about him possibly having, you know, potentially cognitive impairment from something else. Anyhow, so that's one way to treat it. Then if that doesn't work, or if they want to do extra, they can go to chemotherapy. You can also get radiation therapy and bone building therapy. So hopefully he'll be okay and recover well from this. But I'm glad it's in the news. I'm glad it's in, you know, started a conversation about prostate cancer, because men should have the talk with their doctors about whether they want to be screened or whether they don't, because the side effects can from treatment, especially if you're in a healthy 50-year-old man who gets diagnosed with an early stage prostate cancer, if you get treatment, you might have side effects that affect your life more, like urinary incontinence or erectile dysfunction. So you might choose just to watch it and not have any treatment and just see how it progresses. Or you may just choose not to know and only work it up if you're having symptoms. So anyhow, that was what I wanted to discuss on prostate cancer and Joe Biden. Okay, so next, moving away from cancer, but segueing into another form of cognitive impairment, Alzheimer's disease. So this study was really interesting and cool, and what it showed was that cold sore treatment may reduce Alzheimer risk. So why would that be? So new research suggests that treating herpes simplex virus, or HSV-1, which is the virus that causes cold sores, with antiviral medication, so example, Valtrex, you might have heard of here in Canada, acyclovir is another name, will lower the risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. So a large-scale study was done, and the study analyzed data from around 700,000 adults over the age of 50, including 344,000 diagnosed with Alzheimer's and an equal number that didn't have the disease. And what they found was that those with an HSV-1, so cold sore infection, had 80% higher risk of Alzheimer's. And that among those people with the HSV-1, those who used the antiviral medication had a 17% lower risk of developing Alzheimer's compared to those who didn't. So what does this mean? Does this mean that, you know, the herpes simplex virus may contribute to Alzheimer's by triggering inflammation and brain changes similar to those in dementia patients? Yes, it could mean that the virus's DNA is actually found in the amyloid plaques, which is a hallmark of Alzheimer's disease. And other herpes viruses like HSV-2, so that's the one that causes genital herpes, as well as varicella zoster, that's the shingles virus, were also linked to higher Alzheimer's risk. So this is a conversation I've been having with patients who are skeptical of getting the shingles virus. So in Canada, we recommend that patients 50 and over get a shingles vaccine. So why do we recommend that? We recommend that because shingles is a reactivation of the chickenpox virus. So most people used to, or at least when they used to get chickenpox before we vaccinated against it, would get chickenpox as a child, but then that immunity would wear off, and so it would get reactivated in the form of shingles when that person was older. And, you know, shingles is not comfortable. It's a painful rash, and about 10% of people can get what we call a post-herpetic neuralgia, where it's, you know, ongoing pain even once the shingles clears up. That can be very uncomfortable. And if you get it in a dermatome like the eye or some, you know, a dermatome that's more sensitive, you could have other complications like vision as well. So obviously we want to prevent against that. But also a new study has come out showing that they're finding that patients who got the shingles vaccine are less likely to get Alzheimer's. So it could be, again, due to this brain inflammation. So I think the benefit of not having shingles, plus the potential that it reduces Alzheimer's risk, that in of itself, I think is good enough reason to make sure that you talk to your doctor about getting that vaccine. So I know after COVID, there was a lot of, you know, vaccine fatigue. No one wants to get another vaccine. You feel good. You feel healthy. What do you want to give yourself a needle for? But there are benefits. And so this new study does show that. So they asked some experts what they thought about the study about the cold sore treatment being related to less Alzheimer's, and here were some of what people said. So Professor Tara Spires-Jones emphasized that HSV1 does not guarantee Alzheimer's, but it could contribute via brain inflammation. Dr. David Vickers criticized the study's focus on HSV1, noting it's present in only 0.44% of Alzheimer's cases and said the benefit of antivirals was modest. And then Dr. Richard Oakley cautioned that the study does not prove causation, meaning there was just a correlation. It doesn't say that it caused Alzheimer's, and instead it relied on insurance records, which may have had some limitations in their accuracy. But the bottom line is there's a potential link between herpes virus infections and Alzheimer's, and when you treat them with antiviral medications, you're possibly getting some protection against Alzheimer's. So given that there's not much downside in treating the cold sore, and given that there's not much downside to getting the shingles vaccine, the fact that it could help prevent your risk of Alzheimer's, I think is huge, and I think makes it very worthwhile. And I think as a family doctor, after seeing the study, what I would encourage other doctors to do as well is just keep an eye on your practice and try to make a mental note of the patients that you end up diagnosing with Alzheimer's. Do you notice that they had cold sores more often? And are you going to treat them more often with Valtrex or antiviral medication rather than just saying, oh, okay, it's fine, just use ice, you know, on it or take a pain reliever? Anyhow, that was an interesting study as well. So those are two of the main health topics that are a bit more serious I want to talk about. Now, if I had Catherine here today, I would take a deep dive into Kris Jenner. So Kris Jenner is Kim Kardashian's mom. She's responsible. She's the mummager, you know. She's helped her daughters become wildly successful. So Kylie Jenner has her uber successful makeup line. Kim Kardashian obviously has become incredibly successful, now just got her law degree, and I think she's going to be in a TV show coming out soon that I'm looking forward to watching. And anyhow, she looks unbelievable. So if you've been following social media and you've seen pictures of her going around, so she was just in Paris because it was Lauren Sanchez, who's the fiance of, I forget the guy's name, the Amazon founder, I don't know why I'm blanking on his name right now. But because Lauren Sanchez is making the news more so than he is these days. Anyhow, they were in Paris, and they all looked amazing. Katy Perry was there, which I actually found interesting because I wouldn't really think of Katy Perry being friends with Kardashians and Lauren Sanchez, but I guess she is. Eva Longoria, and then you had Kim Kardashian and Kris Jenner. And Kris Jenner is 69, and she obviously just had work done, and she looks unbelievable. Now, I think there was obviously some incredible makeup done and some fancy AI or editing or something, but I saw actually videos of her moving around, and it's clear that she's had work done on her face. That's incredible. So people have been speculating on the internet, what did she have done? So my take on it is, I mean, clearly she's had a facelift, and I'm sure this is not her first. I'm sure she's had a lot of work done already. But they're thinking that she had a deep plane facelift. And, you know, this is a different era of facelift. So, you know, when you used to think of facelift, you think of the Joan Rivers tight, pulled back face. This is a more softer, youthful, not overly pulled face. And I think they're also doing fat grafting as well, because part of what causes the skin to age and the face to look aged as you get older is obviously there's the lack of collagen, but we also lose fat in our face. We lose the fat pads, you know, in areas under our eyes, and that's why we can get deeper tear troughs. We lose fat in our cheek area. So we lose this fat, and we also lose the collagen, and it causes things to sag. Well, the facelift's going to tighten the face, so get rid of that sagging skin, but it's not going to add back the youthfulness and the plumpness to the face. And that's why I think they're doing more and more fat grafting. I know it's become very popular with lower blepharoplasties. That's the under eyelid surgeries, where they're not just tightening it up anymore, but they're also adding fat back there, which looks really natural and can really make the face look more youthful. So the speculation is she's had blepharoplasty, which is eyelid surgery, upper and lower with the fat grafting. She's had a deep plane facelift, probably with some fat grafting in her cheeks as well. It looks like she's had a nose job refinement. Her nose looks perfect. It actually looks a lot, she actually looks a lot like Kim. Like if you, at first glance, you might actually think it was Kim Kardashian as opposed to just her mom. And probably also some laser resurfacing on her skin. So one of the more popular treatments is called CO2. It requires a little bit more downtime. And they basically like burn off the top layer of the skin. So you're going to get that more youthful, younger looking skin coming underneath. So I think that's what she's had done. She looks unbelievable. And if Catherine was here, I know that she'd have some thoughts on it as well. And before Adam joins us, I'm pretty sure this is not something that he would want to talk about. It's funny because every time I talk to a patient that's looking at doing some sort of beauty treatment, they all say the same thing. Like, my husband is against it. My husband has no interest in me getting a facelift. But then you see them like that. And a lot of these women that are getting it done well now, it doesn't look like they're walking around looking weird or overly done. I think a lot of men still think of plastic surgery like that old Joan Rivers look or like the overly tight face, or they think of it like the giant big plump lips and cheeks. And now there's like sort of a movement away from that to a more subtle, refined, natural look. So kudos to her. Looks amazing. And I want to know who her surgeon was, although I'm pretty sure he would probably be a fortune. So, you know, speaking of Joan Rivers as well, I was reminded recently that she actually died from plastic surgery. So that's something to think about as well. You know, more and more, it's almost becoming with wealthy people and celebrities that surgery is becoming something they don't just do once, but regularly. I mean, if I had to guess how many plastic surgeries Kris Jenner's had over her lifetime, I mean, I think you're definitely over 10, you know? And if women are starting younger and younger with this, then, you know, there is risk to it. It's not just the same thing as, you know, getting your makeup done, getting your hair done, getting a Botox treatment. It's surgery, and there are risks that come with surgery. So that's something just to be mindful of. And I know now with, you know, more people aspiring to look like some of these celebrities who can't afford to have it done, you know, they're looking at going to, you know, other countries to get surgeries done more cheaply. And you have to be aware that complications can arise. So, you know, make sure that we all want to look better, but make sure that you understand also that there's risks involved, and you always have to think of your health first before, you know, more vain or aesthetic, you know, wants. Because, you know, once something's wrong with your health, nothing else matters. Anyhow, moving along from that topic, Adam's going to join us soon. And, you know, I always say on this podcast, I'm more health. You know, I'm a doctor. What I bring to this podcast is my views on health, aesthetics, you know, screenings, treatments. But as a professional and somebody who works for income and money and is thinking about my retirement, my future, my kids' future, making money, obviously I am also knowledgeable about the market, and the stock markets are something I look at. I think about how I'm going to invest my money. And so the same way that my patients, who are not necessarily trained in medicine, can go online and use ChatGPT or read health articles and read health books and become knowledgeable about health topics, I've over the years become knowledgeable about investing and investing topics. And then I rely on experts and talking to them to ask questions and help me understand things that, you know, are still a bit confusing. So one of the articles that I woke up to this morning, I opened my phone and on my Apple News, there was an article, I think it was in the Globe and Mail, and I'm going to look at the title, that basically said, let me pull it up here, Trump's new bill builds a bigger tax burden for Canadian portfolios. So what does that mean? Okay, so it said the US bill could override the tax treaty and cost Canadian investors $81 billion over 7 years, warns the industry. So that got me thinking about, you know, what is the tax treaty we have with the US? I've never thought about it before in terms, I know that, you know, when you invest in equities and stocks and you sell those, you know, and if you've made a profit, you have to pay tax on the profit here in Canada. But what happens to, you know, the stocks that you invest in the US, especially the ones that are paying you dividends? So they withhold some tax in the US before they pay you the dividend. And that tax that they withhold is only 5%. But what Trump is proposing is that he's going to make that tax closer to 30%. So that means we're going to be getting less money, keeping less money in our pocket from our American investments. So Adam will talk more about this, but that was just my base understanding of it. We can also talk about the other things in the market. So right now, the market is down, and it says Trump's latest tariffs threat knock North American and European stocks. So the U.S. stock markets dropped, and Canada's TSX were flat today after Trump recommended 50% tariffs on the European Union, and Apple slid after he warned that the company would have to pay tariffs if its phones were not made in the U.S. So, like, you know, if you own Apple stock, now they're saying they're going to have to pay more money if the phones aren't made in the U.S. Well, when I look at Trump doing these tariffs, I mean, everybody's talking, if you listen to any of the podcasts, they're all talking about how, you know, how is the U.S. going to get out of the massive debt that it's in? You know, how is it going to raise more revenue? How's, you know, they either have to cut their expenses on certain funding, certain programs, which they're doing, or they have to raise more money. How can they raise more money? Through these tariffs. So when you look at him putting, oh, this is how I look at it. When he's putting these tariffs on everything, on the one hand, the company has a choice, right? They can say, okay, all right, we're going to make all our phones in the US now. Or they're going to say, that's not realistic. We're going to continue to make our phones in India or China or wherever they make their phones, and we'll just pay that tax. And that's one way for Trump to raise revenue for the US government. You know, similarly, by taxing Canadians on our dividend income, it's another way for them to raise more money. Because I get it, from their perspective, they need money. The U.S. has a massive debt burden. And I guess tariffs are one way of raising money. On the other hand, it could backfire. And look what happens with the markets. They fall. And, you know, people may not want to invest in the U.S. So he's also saying, you know, Canadian corporations are going to be penalized if a Canadian corporation sets up a business or owns a factory in the US, now they're going to have to pay way higher tax on those profits made there. So who's going to want to do business in the US if you're going to be taxed like crazy? So anyhow, there's lots of uncertainty. And again, as an investor, it's stressful when this happens, because one day the markets could go up because he says something, the next day they're going to go down because he says another thing. And it's just constant, you know, ups and downs. So when I think about investing, unless you're trading daily and moving quickly on all this news, then I've just personally decided to keep my plan of just the dollar cost averaging. So I just basically every 3 months, no matter what, I stick with my plan and invest regardless of what the headline says, hoping that over time, none of this noise is going to matter. And things will continue to go up as they have over history. Anyhow, soon I'm going to check on Adam, see if he's online soon. Hang on. And while we're waiting for him, I wanted to talk a little bit about vitamin D. So vitamin D is, I would say, one of the more frequently recommended vitamins in my practice. And it's been in the news a lot. And I think people started getting more interested in vitamin D during COVID when there was some correlation between people faring better from who had COVID, recovering better or not getting COVID when they supplemented with vitamin D. So I think a lot of people thought it was an easy thing to do to start taking vitamin D. Plus, people were spending a lot of time indoors and weren't getting that sunlight exposure that helps the body create vitamin D. So there was a lot of deficiency. Now, there was a book that I talked about on my social media account recently called Super Agers. Now, this book was written by Dr. Topol, who is a longevity expert in the U.S. And to use a market term, he's very bearish on vitamins and supplements. When he looks through all the evidence, he does not believe there is any good medical evidence to recommend any vitamin or supplement to help with longevity unless you have a proven deficiency. So if you're, you know, vitamin B12 deficient, yes, take B12. If you're iron deficient, yes, supplement with iron. If you have a severe vitamin D deficiency, yes, take vitamin D. But he doesn't think people should just be taking these vitamins and supplements preventatively. So that's his view on it. And then you hear that out of one side of your mouth, and this book's come out where he talks about that. Oh, hi, Adam. How are you?
I'm good.
Good. I'm just finishing up talking about vitamin D, and then we'll dive into who you are and what I'm going to chat about with you.
Great.
I never knew how hard it was to talk to myself for half an hour. Oh, my gosh. And I thought I liked hearing myself speak. I'm ready to stop speaking.
No comment from me.
Okay. Anyhow, I was just talking about vitamin D and how, do you take any vitamins or supplements?
I don't. I used to take vitamin C, but I don't take anything now.
Pardon?
I don't take anything now. No.
Yeah, I didn't think so because I never see you, you know, taking anything in the morning, but I don't know what you do at work. Maybe you load up on vitamins when you're out of my sight, but no, you don't. Anyhow, so I was talking about how this Dr. Topol wrote a book called Super Agers. And he basically says there's no good medical evidence to recommend any vitamin or supplement. It's all kind of BS, and exercise, sleep well, eat a good diet, and that's what you need to do. Unless you have an obvious deficiency. If you have B12 deficiency or iron deficiency, yes, supplement. But if everything's normal, there's no benefit to taking extra. But a headline that came across my desk this week was that they found a study showing that people who supplemented with vitamin D3 had lengthened their telomeres. So telomeres are sort of the caps on the end of our chromosomes, okay? And shorter telomeres are associated with worse longevity, okay? So you want to keep your telomeres long. So whenever I think about it sort of like tires, right? When you've been driving a car a long time, those tires get worn down. And worn down is a sign of an aged car, right? So we don't want to have worn down telomeres. We want to have long telomeres. So this new study showed that vitamin D3 supplementation can help lengthen our telomeres, which is counter to what Dr. Topol recommended. Bottom line, am I going to start taking vitamin D? No, not yet. Because I get a lot of sun, I eat a lot of dairy products, and I'm confident in my telomeres. How do you feel?
I drink a lot of coffee, which has cream in it, so I'm assuming that my vitamin D levels are good, perhaps except for wintertime, where I don't get a lot of sunlight.
Okay, well, have you ever tested it?
I have not.
So we include, like at my office, when people come in for a physical, I include their vitamin D level on their blood work. It's a paid test. Like the government doesn't pay for this test. If you want to have your vitamin D tested, you either have to have it included with your program or pay for it outside of OHIP. Every time I've ever tested mine, it's been high normal without taking a supplement. If I took mine and I found that it was low, I probably would feel inclined to take the supplement. So I think it's actually worthwhile for you to do that test. So as part of your physical, you should do that. And earlier on, I was talking about prostate screening because I was talking about the news about Joe Biden and how he was just diagnosed with stage 4 prostate cancer. And then we started talking about the controversy about PSA testing as a screening test. Have you ever had your PSA tested?
I think I did a long time ago.
Okay.
It's been a while since I've seen a physician in their office. It's been at least a couple of
years. Right, you see me at home all the time.
I do.
Right, and I can't be your physician, so it would require you to then rely on someone else but me for anything in your life.
Yes.
Okay. So I'm asking the question. So I was talking about earlier how the Canadian Task Force on Preventative Health actually recommends against PSA testing for anybody. They say there's strong evidence against recommending it for men that are 50 and younger, and there's strong evidence against recommending it for men that are 70 or over. In that 55 to 70 window, they're saying there's weak evidence against it. They still don't recommend it. So then it becomes a question, but the Canadian Urological Association does recommend it. So it's very confusing as a doctor to know, should you include it in their blood work panel or should you not? And it becomes a question that you have to talk to your patient about. Would you want to know? So the reason the Canadian Task Force says don't test is because they don't believe it decreases mortality significantly. And they think it comes with unnecessary stress, biopsies, and potential complications of treatment, like erectile dysfunction or urinary incontinence. So they don't think it's worth it. So if I was going to ask you, like, let's say I was your family doctor, and I said, do you want me to include your PSA test? What do you think?
I'm probably going to say yes, because I don't think it costs me any more to get it.
It does. It's a private pay test.
It is a private pay test. I would actually be more interested to understand what is a better biomarker or indicator for prostate cancer.
There is no better one.
There's no better one. It's only PSA.
Yeah. Yes,
I think notwithstanding the lack of importance or data around its predictability of prostate cancer, if it's the only one that's available, I think you want to have it because there's so many good treatments for prostate cancer, right? So I would want to know if I'm at risk. I think the way they track it, you know this better than I, but I often chime in on what I know. But, it's the rate at which that PSA level is doubling that matters. And so if I see that going up year over year and at an increasing rate, that's going to be at least an early warning system that it needs to be investigated further. I think that in and of itself adds value for a very treatable, otherwise potentially dangerous disease.
So then you would side on the viewpoint of the Canadian Urological Association. That's their viewpoint. Now, if I said to you, okay, so let's say we do your PSA and they're saying, well, it's, early, it's low grade. This probably is not going to become a problem for 15 years, you're probably more likely to die with prostate cancer than of prostate cancer. So we can not treat it and just keep an eye on it. Or we can treat it, but the side effect might be you have erectile dysfunction and you have urinary incontinence, meaning you can't control your bladder.
Right.
So what they're saying is, and I have seen as a result of men getting prostate cancer treatments, we see that pretty often, that can have those side effects. So you might then say, did these side effects cause more problems than the prostate cancer was going to cause? But it's such high-level thinking, and it's something that how can a doctor – we don't know. No one has a crystal ball. So they say it's one thing to say, oh, just have this discussion with your patient. Well, we're already so time-constrained. Most doctors don't have the 20 minutes to sit there with their patient, and confuse them. So anyhow, it's just interesting.
Yeah, I would get more testing more frequently if I saw that was becoming a risk.
You just want to keep an eye on it.
Yeah, you keep a closer eye on it. And then maybe you start treatment, and if it's so, the side effects are so pronounced that they're impacting your daily life, then maybe you halt treatment, if that's an option.
But it's already done. The damage is already done.
It's not reversible. It's not a...
No, so sometimes from radiation it can cause those side effects.
Oh, yeah, I think radiation is a much bigger step from a treatment perspective than I thought, which would have been some form of medication that you would take as a first-line therapy.
No, so usually you're not going to go on like androgen deprivation therapy. You could. It could be androgen deprivation therapy. But what that means to anybody listening is that you're basically reducing your testosterone level. So if you think about it like as being a woman, just saying, go into like a induced menopause, basically. So when men do that, sometimes they can have, depression, anxiety, brain fog, decreased muscle mass, decreased libido. It's one thing if you're 80 dealing with some of those issues. If you're Joe Biden, as Kamala likes to. Who's the actress on Saturday Night Live that always called that played Kamala that always called him Joe Biden? You know the woman I'm talking about.
Maya Rudolph.
Is that her?
Yeah, I think so. I can't remember her last name.
Anytime I think about Joe Biden, I think about her saying Joe Biden. But anyhow. Okay, moving on. Let's talk about the markets. I know you've been on calls all morning, so have you looked? They're down.
I saw, yeah, that there was some tariff announcement or tax announcement, the big greatest bill ever that was passed by the House yesterday and Trump. I haven't read into any of the details, but I know that it's increased tax on potentially foreign companies. And so that, you know, has the same flavor of tariffs on foreign companies, and therefore that spooked the market. There was also a big issuance of treasuries, 20-year treasuries this week that didn't go as well as historically. And so the yields backed up as the prices go down. Price and yield are inversely related. So that is just an indicator that the cost of borrowing money in the United States is getting more expensive because the perceived risk is higher. So that's also, as debt gets
more, what do you mean the cost of borrowing money in the United States?
Well, most countries, the U.S., Canada included, have running deficits that need to be funded with debt. And so they issue bonds or notes to the market.
To raise money.
Individual investors, institutional investors, foreign investors will buy these notes. They form what they call the risk-free rate, whether it's the 1, 3, 10, 30-year bond rates on those sovereign pieces of debt. That's the debt cost of capital for borrowing that money to spend it on social programs and the like in defense.
So you're saying interest rates, they want people, in order to lend money to the U.S., they want a higher interest.
Exactly.
They want a higher return on that money.
That's right.
And that means it's not good for the U.S. because when the U.S. has to ultimately pay them back, they're paying them back more money.
It's just like when you get a mortgage, right? If the rate's higher, you're spending more on interest than you are on everything else that you could spend that money on.
So do you think this is why Trump feels so bullish on tariffs? Because he's looking to raise money for the U.S. to reduce the deficit?
I wouldn't proclaim to understand or pontificate on what he's thinking. I do think there is some method to his madness, right? Many of his announcements and policies are, I believe, designed to invoke a negotiation or start a negotiation or to accelerate a negotiation. So his specific targeting of Canadian products for tariffs, Apple products for tariffs, European products for tariffs are directly as a result of not getting to a conversation that he's accepted of or that he feels is a acknowledgement that a deal needs to be worked out. And so it's his method to force that conversation faster. Whether or not it ultimately passes or goes through, I think we've seen some of it stick and a lot of it being sort of kicked down the road to another negotiation.
So do you think that if this passes and goes through, this changed the U.S.-Canadian tax treaty? So I was talking about it earlier, how the article said, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, that right now, if you're invested in a U.S. dividend-paying stock, so as an example, Wells Fargo or Pfizer, okay? So regardless of whether that stock is doing well, poorly, going up, going down, if they pay a dividend, you're collecting money, dividend income on that money, every quarter or however often they pay out their dividend money. So let's say you're collecting a dollar, okay? So right now, before they pay you that dollar of income, they withhold 5 cents or 5%. Is that correct?
Depends. So if you're a foreign investor investing in U.S. securities, that
as a Canadian, what if that's
so yes, there's a withholding tax that is deducted from the source. So they don't. You actually, if the dividend's a dollar, you don't get the full dollar. You get some lesser amount. Because you're typically, as a Canadian, not a U.S. taxpayer. So they want to make sure that a foreign investor, Canadian or otherwise, is paying something for receiving that income that otherwise would go to an American who would pay tax on it, likely.
Okay, so we're being so on your dividend income, you're being taxed that 5% before it even gets to you. And so then that 95 cents that's left, you're then being taxed on the Canadian side.
Correct. Your correct. Canadian tax return will have that listed as dividend income, non-Canadian eligible dividend income, just regular other income, and that's going to get taxed likely at your marginal tax rate.
Unless it's in your TFSA.
Unless it's in your RSP or your TFSA, which I think is interesting, and not that I'm providing any sort of tax advice. Everyone should talk to their tax experts. But my understanding is that a U.S. dividend-paying stock is not subject to withholdings tax in your registered retirement account, so an RSP or a LIRA, but it is subject to withholding tax in a regular margin account or a cash account or your TFSA, which is not deemed a retirement account, a registered retirement account.
Okay.
It's very slight nuance different, but can be important if you're buying.
Okay, so that's why they're saying this proposed change. So now they're withholding 5%. But what Trump is proposing is that he wants to say that over the next few years, it will get as high as 30%. He thinks that's the fair rate. So that's going to really affect Canadians' RSP accounts, retirement accounts.
Yeah, and it's going to dramatically, if that passes.
And their GFSA, all our investments.
Yeah, if that happens, it'll make the yield on those dividends or those dividend U.S. paying stocks much less compelling as an investment compared to a Canadian dividend-paying stock or Australian or a European, right?
It
may not be subject to the same withholding tax. I'd also argue that that's probably a reason why they may not go through with it, right? If you make your investments less attractive to foreigners, you know, some of those foreigners are going to sell that security, pushing down the valuation, pushing down the market, and that's going to have a negative impact on or increase, just like we talked about in bonds, the more money it costs to attract an investor into your share, the higher the cost of that capital is.
So where I understand it affecting, like if I was going to look at my own portfolio, I might say, okay, I've held on to Pfizer, it hasn't done that well, but it pays a good dividend. But if all of a sudden now I have to pay, if there's a 30% withholding tax on that dividend, I may not find it worthwhile to hold on to. I therefore may sell it, and that would be bad for some of the U.S. companies. Where I do see the U.S. benefiting from this is how index funds have become so popular, and for the stocks that make up part of that fund that pay a dividend, I don't think I'm necessarily selling my S&P 500 index fund just as a result of this. So it's a way that they can make some money on that.
Yeah. I think it's a very lucrative tax grab that the U.S. can pass and at the same time not really impact U.S. voter sentiment, right? This is the foreigners. If Americans are anything, they're patriotic. And if it's not an American being impacted by it directly, right, there's an indirect impact here that I think is probably an unintended consequence that no one's thought about or they haven't thought about through this policy. But putting that aside, this is a very easy way to say we're not taxing Americans, we're taxing foreigners who own American securities.
Right. And it may be like you talk about putting himself in a good negotiation position. It might be a way to have Canada get rid of the digital service tax that they put in. Say, okay, we won't do this, but you get rid of that tax. So it might just be a way to, you know, increase their bargaining power.
Yeah, I think that's probably likely what's going to happen here is they'll use it as collateral, as a negotiation tool.
Yeah. Now, when he talked also, in addition to this dividend tax, he was also talking about how if you're a foreign country, like if you're let's talk about Canada, and you're a Canadian corporation and you do business in the U.S., like if you own a factory or if you own a company in the U.S., he's now going to subject those profits to a much higher tax rate as well. So that's really going to impact Canadian companies wanting to do business there, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's the same concept, right? Whether you own one share of Pfizer or you own a U.S. business, if you're paying a dividend, right, it would impact your U.S. subsidiary paying a dividend to your Canadian right company or your Canadian personal account as a shareholder, it's the same concept. The dividend withholding tax rate is going to impact it whether it's a public company or a private company. I don't think they'll make a distinction, and it's rare that they do, between those two.
But it's like, if you're a company, like I think we talked about an example earlier of it was funny because when I looked this up earlier, I said, well, what? Give me an example of a company who owns factories in the U.S. And you're like, Magna.
Yeah.
Right? Magna. But at the same time, you were, I was looking it up on ChatGPT, and you guys both at the same time gave the same answer. So explain to me again what that means, what Magna does and the companies they might own there.
So Magna is a internationally Canadian domiciled auto parts and auto component manufacturer. So we'll make certain pieces of cars, whether it's the dashboard or the seats, an engine block. You know, I don't know all the details, but each one of those component parts that goes into cars, they either make or sometimes they assemble. And they've got manufacturing plants throughout the world. They're a Canadian company. But they have U.S. plants. And so those plants in the States that sell products to the U.S. market but are Canadian, ultimately owned,
right,
are potentially subject to this increase in tax. And so if they're repatriating the capital back to Canada to reinvest in, say, another country or in Canada and not in the States, that dividend withholding tax or that increased tax could apply to those dollars.
Okay.
It's said another way is it's an incentive for them to reinvest those dollars back into the U.S. So not take that money out of the American jurisdiction and, you know, maybe build another plant in the U.S. or expand an existing plant.
Yeah, and I was talking earlier on how now he's also including as part of this bill higher tariffs on EU and how he's saying that Apple is going to get a 20% tariff if their iPhones are made outside of the U.S.
Yeah, he was, I think there was a mention, you know, doesn't want them made in India, he wants them made in the United States.
Right, because I guess Apple's, when he was putting this tariff on China, I guess Apple's like, okay, we're going to move our operations to India then.
Yeah, say no. I think that's an interesting and perhaps more damaging policy, right? If everybody makes fun of my iPhone 12, I haven't upgraded in quite some time. But if I was looking to upgrade a phone, if I was an American and all of a sudden I have to pay American labor costs and assembly costs and material costs for everything that goes into an iPhone, that phone's going to be de facto a lot more expensive and that's going to get a lot more attention than, say, a foreign dividend withholding tax amount.
Yeah.
And so I think that policy is flawed for a lot of reasons, both on, you know, trying to have competitive advantages around where do you want to manufacture goods, particularly high tech goods, as well as the practical reality of having a higher cost ubiquitous item in the States that only gets more expensive because you're forcing or incentivizing the manufacturer in that country.
I know, but it's like they're saying, like, you know, if they start making phones in the U.S., like, how much is an iPhone going to cost? Like, $5,000?
Yeah,
like,
there's a comedian who made a joke about, you know, if we...
Yeah, like, keep them made there. I don't want to pay $5,000.
You know, they're going to be $3,000 cell phone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyhow, okay, thanks for filling in for Catherine.
My pleasure. Not as pretty, but...
And I guess I didn't even introduce you. I introduced you a little bit earlier, but just to give people a bit of your background... You are a CFA, you've worked in private equity, you've worked in investment banking, you've worked in biotech, you've worked in real estate. So I should probably, like, give you credit for knowing things more often than I do. But
yeah, our relationship is interesting that way, right?
Yeah, but, you know, then I just wouldn't be me,
right.
You wouldn't be you. Anyhow, thanks for filling in. And I'm looking forward to the next time we're on vacation. I can't wait to see Catherine and Les's podcast.
Yeah, that'll be a good one.
That'd be a good one.
I think Les and I should have a podcast as well.
Oh, yeah, maybe.
We should come on after. Maybe it's a much shorter but more commentary on the podcast.
Oh, that would be good. Okay, sounds good. All right, bye.
Bye.